Okay, good morning, everyone. Now, let me just make clear while we're talking about this. The idea that God evolves or changes, even though there is some, there certainly is a lot of warrant for that in the Bible, and some thinkers have alluded to that. That's not the classical view at all of God in the Jewish tradition. Malachi says, I am God, I don't change. And if you ask most modern traditional or almost all modern traditional thinkers, they assume that God doesn't change because to change means to be imperfect and to have to learn and to have to grow and all of that. And that's a much more Reconstructionist view of God, Kaplanian view of God, and not at all a classical Maimonidean or rabbinic view of God. So even though if you read the Bible on its own, that may seem to be what happens, you should just know that that's not the way the Jewish tradition interpreted it for most of Jewish history. So for better or worse, there you have it. It depends who you ask in the conservative movement. If you ask someone like David Novak, probably he would say that God doesn't change. If you ask someone like Neil Gilman, he would probably say that God does. Harold Kushner says God does. Well, a lot of it has to do with, I would say this, there are different ways. It depends whether you're talking about God's essence or God's manifestations in the world. I mean, we think of, you know, that's Kabbalah sort of splits up God in a way that makes sense, sort of. We don't know what God's essence is. I mean, Joseph Albo, who was a medieval Jewish, late medieval Jewish philosopher, said, in order to know God, I would have to be God. Because no human could possibly know. So I wouldn't say anything about God's essence. God's essence perhaps does not change. But our experience of God in the world is that God does change. Our experience of God reading the Bible is that God does change. But what God is in fact...
Is there a message there?
I don't know. I don't know. For anybody who happens one day to be listening to this on tape, a balloon of Nemo.
Nemo, that is exactly who it is.
I have a little girl at home. I know Nemo. Went across the light that was and darkened the room. Anyway, so just as I said, it's just the rabbinic phrase is Torah dibra bilshon b'nei adam. The Torah speaks in the language of human beings. So in order to explain the way God works so that we can understand, it uses human terms. Otherwise, if you don't use human terms about God, you can't talk about God at all, because the only terms we have are human terms. So even though God doesn't really change, we talk about God as though God changes because those are the only words we have.
Because of our limitations.
Right. Because of the limitations of language. The philosopher Wittgenstein said, the limits of my language are the limits of my world. If you don't have words to describe something, then it's not real. And the Torah is obviously a book of words, so it can't describe what God is like other than to say, you know. That's why, by the way, Maimonides, while we're on the subject, because it's actually an important subject in the history of Jewish philosophy, that's why Maimonides said you cannot say what God is, only what God is not. Because as soon as you say God is something, you limit God. Right? As soon as you define something with any attribute, you're saying it is this. And everything that is this has limits. I could say God is not the rug And I haven't limited God, because there are infinite number of things that are not the rug. But as soon as I say God is good, according to Maimonides, that limits God, because good is a certain thing, right? It's a certain combination of characteristics. So as far as Maimonides is concerned, if you're really careful, you do what's called negative theology, which is you only talk about what God is not. God is not corporeal, physical. God is not limited. God is not evil. God is, and so on. That's how hard it is to get into the idea of talking about God and why classical Judaism, and my guess is, by the way, classical Islam, too, talks about God this way. And I say that, classical Islam, and I didn't say Christianity, because this allowed me in high school to have this argument. For those of you who are interested in a more elaborate discussion of this, it's on BeliefNet, beliefnet.com, which I write a column on, and I have a column there about why Jews don't accept Jesus. And at the beginning of that column, I tell the story about when I was in high school and this Baptist minister came to speak to us. Now, I went to Akiba Hebrew Academy in Philadelphia, right? It was a Jewish high school, and obviously every kid in the class was Jewish, and he said to us, "You seem like nice boys and girls, but if you don't accept Jesus, you're all going to hell." So, which is what a lot of people in this country believe, by the way. So I spent, you know, I was trying to think of something that would make him look bad because I was, you know, an obnoxious 11th grader. So what I finally said to him was, is it true that, the Christian Trinity is made up of the Father, Son, and the Holy Ghost, three in one and one in three. It's based on a paradox. So I said to him, is the Father perfect? And he said, yes. I said, is the Son perfect? He said, yes. I said, is the Holy Spirit perfect? And he said, yes. I said, well, then you don't need two out of the three, because by definition, if something is perfect, you don't have to add anything to it. If you have to add something to it, it's not perfect. To which he said, that's the mystery of the Trinity. Now, I didn't like the answer, and I felt like I won, right? But he probably didn't think so, because that is part of the difference between the Jewish idea and the Christian idea of God, is that God comes to earth, becomes human and divine at the same time, is imperfect but perfect, and all of that, and clearly participates in all the human, right? But classically, Judaism hasn't seen God that way, at least not philosophically. And Maimonides' views are usually what people refer to when they talk about God being perfect. But you know, if God doesn't change God's mind, if God never grows, then a lot of the tradition doesn't seem to make sense. Like, why would you pray for something unless you were trying to persuade God to do it? Why do you say, forget even praying for your own health, grant peace in Israel? Now, if God was already going to do whatever God was going to do, why say grant peace in Israel? It's already either God was going to grant peace or God wasn't going to grant peace. So when you talk in human terms about a perfect entity, it's very hard. It's very hard. And we find that again and again in the Bible, and we will find it again and again. So, okay. Let's move to something very human, which is circumcision. Yeah. Well, look, all right. We are on verse 9, chapter 17 of Genesis. Okay. Now, God further said to Abraham, as for you, you and your offspring shall come throughout the ages, shall keep my covenant. We talked about that last time, right? That all of us are obligated, even though all of us weren't, we weren't there except according to the Jewish tradition, we were there. That everybody stood at Sinai. And in fact, that's why that idea that every Jew stood at Sinai, which we talked about last time, that's why one of the most important books of modern feminist Jewish theology, written by Judith Plaskow, is called Standing Again at Sinai. In other words, she wants to stand at Sinai, but again, in a sort of different way. So, as for you, you and your offspring to come throughout the ages shall keep my covenant. Such shall be the covenant between me and your offspring to follow, which you shall keep. Every male among you shall be circumcised. So first God says you're going to keep the covenant and then defines what the covenant is, which is circumcision. Why circumcision? Why is that, of all the things that God could have chosen, give me some reasons why circumcision would be the sign of the covenant. Yeah. Okay, a piece of yourself, it's irreversible. It's like a sacrifice, but a symbolic sacrifice because, you know, the sacrifice lives, and in a real sacrifice, the sacrifice dies. What else? Maybe, although it doesn't, it's in theory, the way the Brit Milah, the Bris developed, if you listen to most, they'll say that it's either, most moils will say it's either painless or it's not very painful. Or I've been to brises where babies cry and I've been to brises where babies don't cry. And I don't know if it's the amount of wine they give them beforehand. but I would say, instead of saying pain, how about just, it's very serious. I mean, it's, you know, it's surgery after all. So that's part of it. What else?
Blood,
right. B'damai chayi, with your blood you shall live. The fact that blood is involved is critical. Remember, blood represents life in the Jewish tradition. That's why you have to drain the blood from an animal before you eat it, because you're not allowed to eat the life of something.
Yeah. Many sins get committed through this sexual drive.
Okay. What nobody said, but as obvious, is that we're talking about sexual organ, which is not only a source of sin often, and I'll talk about that in a second, sexuality and sin, but also fertility. And all of Abraham's story and all of the Jewish story in the Bible is about having children and not being able to have children, and you'll be multitudes and so on. So it's as if God is making a promise at the same place where God makes a promise. That is, at the generative organ, let's put it gently, right? And then there is the issue with sexuality and religion. I'll say two quick things about it, since this is a much larger subject. But when people talk about why it is that religion is so focused on sexuality, which is true, by the way, I think of any discipline that studies human beings, so is psychology, so is sociology, I mean, everybody is. One reason is because it's defining as to human nature. I mean, look, it's not only defining as to human psychology, but Darwinian-wise, until very recently, there was only one way to reproduce, and that was sexually. So it's also part of the fundamental human drive, and also because sexuality is one of those things that can explode the social order, right? Sexuality is one of those, so you can have a perfect, happy, settled, seemingly sedate, group, family, whatever, and all of a sudden sexuality can, I mean, every single movie is about this, right? Sexuality in one way or another upends, destroys, threatens that order. And religion is constantly aware of that. David and Bathsheba, right? Here's the king. Remember what David does? David doesn't just marry a woman who's married, he sends her husband to die. Right? He sends Uriah off to die so that it won't be discovered that he had relations with Bathsheba. Okay? Yeah.
And it's also because at the same time it can get to the most depraved things and to the most
exalted things. Right. The other side of it also is, remember at the very beginning he said it's both depraved and exalted. It's not the highest and the lowest. Remember the first, the first thing that Adam does when they leave the Garden of Eden is he has sexual relations with Eve, and the Hebrew word for sexual relations is yada, which means to know. So there's an intimacy and a knowledge that comes with it that also is on a level much greater and deeper than other things. So there's a lot of reasons why you would think, you know, that if it was clipping your nails, it wouldn't have the same resonance for the covenant. All right. I also want to, if you look, by the way, at other verses that talk about this, circumcision and being uncircumcised becomes a metaphor for lots of other things. Uncircumcised hearts in the Bible are people who are coarse, who don't let God in, who don't listen. I am of uncircumcised lips, Isaiah says, when God wants him to prophesy. And being of uncircumcised lips means in some way that Isaiah isn't pure enough to prophesy. And also, of course, as we mentioned last time, Abraham has to be circumcised before Isaac, whereas Abraham was not circumcised before Yishmael. So there's also a difference in the Abraham who's producing these children, circumcised and uncircumcised. Okay. All right. Verse 11. You shall circumcise the flesh of your foreskin, and that shall be the sign of the covenant between me and you. Now, as I believe, I'm in fact going to read you a little bit of it, as Sarna talks about, God doesn't have to give, remember the instructions that God gave about building an ark to Noah? This many cubits by that many cubits, and so on and so forth. Why doesn't God have to give Abraham instructions about how to circumcise his kid? Because it was a very well-known practice in the ancient world. A lot of people, the Jews did not invent circumcision, apparently. A lot of people circumcised, as there are groups that circumcise today that have nothing to do with Jews or Judaism. I'm going to, at the end, the excursus on circumcision here, let me just read you a little bit about it. Remember, it not only plays a part here. Remember, who saves her husband's life by circumcising their son? Tzipora, right? Moses' wife does that. So we'll come to that at the time. That's one of the most enigmatic, mysterious, difficult stories in the Bible. All right. It says explicitly that you have to be circumcised to participate in the Passover offering. All the Israelites who came out of Egypt were circumcised. Let's see. Circumcision is widely and independently, that means apart from the Bible, attested in the histories of divergent cultures from Anatolia to Western Sudan, from the Australian Aborigines, who apparently circumcised, which I didn't know, to the Maasai of East Africa, from Polynesian cultures to the Kingdom of Lesotho in Southern Africa. Herodotus, the great Greek historian and storyteller, and sometimes both at the same time, reported that the Egyptians practiced circumcision, quote, for the sake of cleanliness, considering it better to be clean than comely. Comely means attractive. So in other words, I guess they considered it unattractive but healthy. And then he goes into lots of other ancient traditions that practice circumcision, which I won't burden you with at the moment. Of all the peoples with whom Israel came into contact, by the way, only the Philistines are called uncircumcised, right? That's a derogatory way of referring to them, those uncircumcised people. But if you call one people uncircumcised, what does that mean about everybody else? That they probably were circumcised. So it was a very widespread practice in the ancient world. Why that is, I'm going to let some anthropologists try to figure out, but it was very widespread. And then, of course, he goes into where else it takes place in the Bible. In those cultures that traditionally practice circumcision, the age at which it's performed varies widely, but the overwhelming preference is at puberty or right before the wedding, a prenuptial rite. In this sense, I believe we do it better. But I haven't interviewed many 9-day-olds to ask them if they would agree. In either case, It takes place at a crucial period in the male life cycle and marks the initiation of the individual into the common life of his group. The biblical shift to the eighth day is a radical break, severing all connection with puberty, marriage, and rites of passage. Therefore, it can have a new and original meaning. The new and original meaning, of course, is that it's a covenant between God and human beings. Right? It's not about becoming a man. That's what the bar mitzvah is for. That's our rite of passage. It's not about entering into the marital state. It's about entering into the covenant with God. Now, why at 8 days? I'll give you three possible answers, and then if you have any others, I'm happy to take them. One is there is apparently medical evidence that certain things kick in, immune systems or whatever, that make it safe at 8 days where it wouldn't be safe at 6 days. That's one. The second is that for the first 7 days, a baby is actually considered, according to Jewish law, part of its mother, right? It's not an independent human being until the eighth day, which is why, actually, although this is painful for some people, according to classical Jewish law, if a child dies before the eighth day, it is not accorded full burial rights. You don't have to say Kaddish and so on. And if that seems harsh to you, just remember it's from a world in which a lot of babies died in childbirth or in the first couple of days. And so I think it was probably to make it less onerous rather than more. But by the time a baby reached the eighth day, already, you know, that was a full-fledged person. And then the third reason, which is the reason that I had always heard growing up and have always given, is that the baby should have at least one Shabbat. And the only way that you can make sure that the child will have a Shabbat is if the child is not circumcised till the eighth day. Okay? What's that? Yes, please. With creation, right. It ties exactly. It ties it to the creation of the world because every human being is a world. So you should go through Shabbat, which was the cessation of the creation of the world. Right? And remember that circumcision is so important that it overrides Shabbat. Right? You can have a circumcision on Shabbat. And also, if you want to figure out, just because people aren't always aware of this, if a child is born before nightfall, that day counts because the Jewish principle of Jewish law is a part of a day counts as a full day. So if you're born Sunday afternoon, the bris is Sunday because Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday is the eighth day. Okay? That day counts as a day. Sunday counts even though you're not alive all of Sunday, even if you're only alive for an hour of Sunday, it counts. Now, if you're born Sunday night, remember, since the Jewish day starts at night, then you don't count Sunday. Then the bris is on Monday. Because according to the Jewish calendar, you weren't born on Sunday. You were born on Yom Sheni, on Monday, since the day starts from night to night. Okay? You don't have to remember this. You can always call the rabbi's office and find out when the bris is. But if you want to know, that's the rule. Okay. Yes. I would say, in my experience, there is no number, especially up to, say, 10 or 13, that doesn't have significances. So there's certainly significance to 3, to 7, to 10. But then you can also find significances, sure, to 2, to 8. Shmini Atzeret is the eighth day of the festival. I mean, there certainly is 8. The eighth day is the day after creation, when things really, bless you, got started after Shabbat. So I'm sure there is. Numerology is a fascinating field in the Jewish tradition. But I can't tell you specifically what 8. It's a good question. If circumcision was so widespread, so why choose that? Why not choose something else? I would say, okay, I'll give you an answer that the rabbi that you talked to before wouldn't like. This was, Erwin talked to a rabbi who, and he mentioned this idea of God's changing, and but the rabbi sent a virus to your computer or something, right? Judaism specializes in adopting practices from other cultures and making them our own. And this, and the only way to deny this is to not study Jewish history, is to only study the Jewish recounting of Jewish history. As soon as you look at other cultures and you see that they were doing the same thing, and sometimes they were doing it before, or magically they were doing it at the same time, then it becomes, you know, then you realize how much Jews take. And by the way, not always take good things. I'll give you a wonderful example of this. I used to study at UCLA, at first at the UJ and then at UCLA, with a remarkable and wonderful man and scholar named Amos Funkenstein, who was, among other things, he was a professor in the UC system. The UC system has 10 what are called university professors. They can teach any course at any UC campus any semester they want, because they're just, Funkenstein was one of them, and he was also a full professor at Tel Aviv University. His fields were history of science, having nothing to do with Judaism, and also Jewish studies. I took lots of different courses with him, but I remember he was talking about asceticism. Asceticism is self-denial. Medieval Jewish mystics used to do the most, like they would beat themselves, they'd roll naked in the snow, they would abstain from sex for months and months and months. All these practices that you think Jews don't do, the mystics of Svat in particular used to do. And Funkenstein, in studying this once, talked to us about the fact that almost all these practices he thought were adopted from Christian mystics. He said they're not attested to, they're not really discussed earlier. They all of a sudden come in, and they remarkably come into the Jewish tradition about the time that that those Jews have contact with Christians who are already practicing this. Now, they're all then given Jewish names, and they're practiced by very renowned Jewish thinkers, but it's almost like the languages that Jews speak. Yiddish is an amalgam of German and Hebrew, right? Ladino is an amalgam of Spanish and Hebrew. Maimonides wrote his philosophical works in Arabic. So it's not uncommon for Jews to actually adopt practices that are originally from other cultures and make them Jewish, which is, I mean, Yiddish is only spoken by Jews. And the Bishop of Rome. Okay, we talked about that last time. So, but if you ask why did God do it, the second answer I would give is the answer that Maimonides gave about sacrifices, which is Maimonides asked why did God, who obviously doesn't need sacrifices, why does God prescribe sacrifices in the temple? And his answer was that the cultures around the Jews at the time practiced human sacrifice. And in fact, we know this now archaeologically. He knew it from tradition. Now we know it because we've actually found altars. God wanted to wean the Jewish people away from that practice. That's part of what he understood the Akedah to be about. God takes Isaac up and then has Abraham take Isaac up. Abraham thinks, well, this is, you know, it's not uncommon for gods to ask for such a thing. And then God says, no, this isn't what I want from you. And instead, sacrifice a ram. So it was weaning away from human sacrifice. But since the Israelites lived at that time, he had to give them something that they would understand and they would be comfortable with and they could practice, because after all, the religion wasn't for gods, it was for people. So my guess is that someone who accepts that other traditions have it would say that God gave Jews what they could understand and do and gave them a new meaning for it. As opposed to asking something, I don't know what else God could ask, but as opposed to asking something. And it's clear, by the way, there are also ancient and modern cultures that practice what is euphemistically called female circumcision, and that was never part of the Jewish tradition. So it's not only what gets accepted, but what gets omitted. So let me just mention one or two other things. First, by the way, you know who is supposed to circumcise a Jewish child? The father, right. And that's why the moel has to be designated as the representative of the parent at the circumcision. He has to be a shaliach. A shaliach is a messenger, and in Jewish law, the messenger is like you. If you're carrying out an officially designated task for me, then you are my legal agent. And, you know, to all purposes, we're identical. Just like when someone says, you know, the lawyer's not doing anything that you didn't hire them to do, the same idea. All right, let me just quickly, I think that's enough. I mean, he talks about other things in terms of circumcision, but really, the only other thing that he talks about is how much Jews have sacrificed for circumcision. It was outlawed in various times under Hadrian, other persecutions. Also, as you know, if you ever read that wonderful book, and if you haven't read that wonderful book, you really should, James Michener's The Source. It will give you a much deeper... James Michener did a wonderful thing. James Michener wrote these long, elaborately researched novels, but they read pretty well. And The Source is one of his best, of the few that I've read. He takes a tell. A tell is, in Israel, sometimes you see these mounds. And they're mounds because layers of civilization are found under them. So they excavate tells and they will find, really, like a cake, one civilization piled on top of another, another, another. And he starts from the beginning and goes up through the tell and tells a story for each layer of civilization, so you see how who was in Israel in each generation and what they experienced. It's called The Source, Hamakor in Hebrew, The Source, although he wrote it in English. And it's by James Michener, M-I-C-H-E-N-E-R. He used to be one of the best-selling authors in the United States. All his books were bestsellers. They're not scholarly or difficult to read. And in the section of The Source where he talks about Hellenistic times, he discusses the fact that there were people who would do surgery to hide circumcisions. Because remember, the Olympic Games were done naked. So if you were a Jew and you wanted to be in the Olympic Games, you would have surgery to hide your circumcision. So circumcision has a long and painful, in many different ways, history in Judaism. But also, I mean, even in up to Nazi Germany and beyond, if you wanted to know if someone was Jewish, you would ask them to strip, and that's how you would know. And there are books and movies and so on that center, in some ways, around this very question. Yeah. Yes. 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 I'm glad you brought that up. Roberta brings up that this was a crucial moment in the history not only of Judaism and Christianity, but of the Western world and, in fact, in world history. When Paul decided that you did not need to be circumcised to be a Christian. Because Christian was a better way of being Jewish. That's how Christianity saw itself, that Jesus was the fulfillment of Jewish promises. And there came a time and the earliest Christians were all Jews. Then there came a time when Christianity had to decide, is this going to be exclusively a religion that will attract Jews, or is it going to proselytize to the Gentiles, to those who are not Jews? And part of the appeal of proselytizing to the Gentiles was to say, you do not have to follow the law, you do not have to be circumcised to be saved. Right? The idea behind Christianity in part was, nobody can really fulfill all the laws. They're too onerous for anybody to do adequately. So, in fact, instead of fruitlessly trying to fulfill all these laws, instead what God really wants from you is not law, but faith. And that was Paul's great message. And involved in that and crucial in that was that circumcision wasn't necessary. And they refer to, for example, when the prophets talk about circumcision of the heart, they refer to that as opposed to actual circumcision. It's instead a spiritual as opposed to a physical process. And this emphasis, it's so, I mean, just yesterday, it's a fascinating thing. The emphasis, which is to some extent, and I want to only say to some extent, on works rather than faith, on this world rather than the next world that somewhat divides Judaism and Christianity. It's exaggerated. I mean, Judaism believes in the next world. Christianity believes in works in this world. I don't want to draw too great a parallel, but there is a clear difference. And I just had a great illustration of this yesterday. I had lunch or breakfast with the guy who headed and runs this BeliefNet site, beliefnet.com, which has every religion on it, Wiccans, Sikhs, Hindu, Muslim, Christian, Jewish, and 20 others that I've never heard of, okay? And he has 100 columnists who all write for it, including lots of Jewish columnists, rabbis, ministers, priests, all sorts of people. It's a very good site. It really is a very good site and worth looking at. Anyway, so, of course, the guy who founded it was a Jew. So, not of course, but he is. So I'm at Steve Waldman from New Jersey. So he was out in Los Angeles, and although we had spoken many times and emailed many times, we'd never actually met, and we had breakfast. And I said to him in the course of the breakfast, what have you learned? Because, I mean, he deals much more now with Christians than he does with Jews because it's a site in America. So, you know, the Christian site gets many, many, many more hits than the Jewish site does, even though the Jewish site, the traffic is, you know, he gets hundreds of thousands of hits, but still, how many Jews are there? And he said, actually, just the other day, there was something so interesting. We were doing, I don't know what it was, something, let's say, about the Iraq war and religion, whatever it was, okay? And one of the Christian, one of our board of directors or our panel who's Christian said, why are we always doing this stuff about politics and religion? Everything with you is, you know, let's have religious leaders comment on something in the newspaper. Why are we always commenting on what's going on in the world? And another one of the board of directors said, it's because he's Jewish. Because the Jewish orientation is to apply religion to things that are going on. Whereas you are much more oriented towards, let's talk about our spiritual life, unconnected to, you know, scandal of money in politics or Iraq or Ariel Sharon is in the hospital or all the things, because we don't have that political orientation in Christianity the same way. So, in fact, that separation into faith from works and also, of course, Jewish history and so on, but it does have a very powerful resonance that you can't escape in some ways. All right, that's a very long answer to a question. But anything else on this? Remember also, circumcision is delayed if there's any threat to the health of the child. And also, by the way, circumcision is delayed if you can't get somebody who is proficient to do the circumcision. So if you can't find a moel to come on Shabbat, which sometimes happens, then you have to delay it to the next day. So, all right. I think that will do it for circumcision background. All right. Okay. By the way, one interesting little footnote that Sarna mentions here, which is if the circumcision has to be postponed, then you don't do it on a Thursday. This seems completely arbitrary, but I'll tell you why. Because according to ancient Jewish wisdom, the pain of the after surgery is most intense on the third day. And so you don't want to have to treat the child if any treatment is needed on Shabbat. So you don't do it on Thursday. And remember, when is circumcision supposed to take place? In the morning, because rezim la mitzvah, the first opportunity you have to do a mitzvah in the Jewish tradition, that's when you do the mitzvah. You don't say, I'll give tzedakah tomorrow. Right? As soon as a mitzvah comes to your hand, you're supposed to do it right away for all the reasons that you know. I don't know where this first came from, but I think I first read it or heard it from Jack Reamer, who is a conservative rabbi, about that for years and years, the devil was trying to tempt this rabbi into doing some avera, some sin. And he could never get him to do it. He would say, ignore your congregation, don't go visit that sick person, whatever it was. But finally, he hit on a strategy that worked. He said to the rabbi, it's very important that you give tzedakah, and I want you to give tzedakah, but you can do it tomorrow. Because delaying the mitzvah is often a very effective way of not doing the mitzvah, right? And procrastination is the enemy of mitzvah, so when you have an opportunity in something like circumcision, you do it right away. Okay, now, also, we talked about last time, and I looked it up so that I could get you a better answer, karet, the question of being cut off and what it means to be cut off from your people. Since someone who, for example, does not observe Pesach or is not circumcised, this is karet. And traditionally, in rabbinic literature, what karet meant was that either you would not have the olam haba, you wouldn't have the world to come, or that you would be cut off from the community. Sometimes premature death is attributed to karet. So is childlessness attributed to karet, for obvious reasons, right? Because to be cut off from your people is also to be cut off in the generations. You know, if you don't have people who come after you, you're cut off from your people. Richard Elliot Friedman also says that sometimes karet was not to be buried in the ancestral tomb or in a Jewish cemetery, because there too you're considered cut off from your people. And then one nice comment from Benno Jacob. This I thought was very interesting. Benno Jacob was a German rabbi who lived actually in Germany. I believe he lived there up to right before the Holocaust, and he left, and his works were saved. Some of them in Germany were not saved, but most of them were. Yeah, his book was published in 1934 in Berlin, so right before the Shoah. But he says something very interesting about what karet is. He says that karet means that when something bad happens to you, it's a punishment. Let me explain what he's saying there. In other words, normally, when something bad happens to you, you shouldn't think of it as a punishment. If you're under karet, if you've been cut off from God's protection, from God's care, then it's a punishment. So he says karet is really a declaration of conscience. Somebody who is in karet will know that when something bad happens to you, it's because God's punishing you. Somebody who's not in karet will know that when something bad happens, whatever the cause of it, it's not because God's punishing you. Which I thought was especially given when he was writing and who he was writing for, I thought was a fascinating way of interpreting what it means to be cut off from your people. So anyway, I wanted to bring that. Benno Jacobs has a lot of very interesting stuff, and I will I'll bring his comments along the way as we... This is the verse, it's verse 14, you shall be circumcised in the flesh of your foreskin. A male who is uncircumcised and has willfully remained so, in other words, it's got to be your choice, right? If you can't help it, you can't help it. Is punished by being cut off from his people. The expression is taken from the felling of a tree, Deuteronomy 19:5, and refers to the strokes of fate which will fell him unless they are turned aside by God. This is an ingenious idea in the true prophetic spirit. Such blows strike every man. In other words, everybody gets those blows of fate. But for the Israelite, they are raised to a matter of conscience. If he has broken God's covenant, he should regard them as a punishment which has been foretold to him. And that's all he says. In other words, if he hasn't, they're not a punishment. It's all a question of conscience. Okay. We have time to at least do another verse or two. And throughout the generations, every male among you shall be circumcised at the age of 8 days. As for the homeborn slave and the one bought from an outsider who is not of your offspring, they must be circumcised, homeborn and purchased alike. Thus shall my covenant be marked in your flesh as an everlasting pact. And if any male who is uncircumcised fails to circumcise the flesh of his foreskin, that person shall be cut off from his kin. He has broken my punishment. Shall be cut off. There are 36 instances of this formula in the Torah. I'm quoting now from Sarna. In other words, karet is mentioned 36 times. All of them listed in the Mishnah. And the punishment is peculiar to ritual texts and is largely confined to offenses of a cultic and sexual nature. In other words, you don't cut somebody off for stealing something. It's cultic and sexual. Now, why would it be cultic and sexual? Probably because those are community sins, right? Relational sins. Sins of the cult are done together, right? Cultic means ritual sins. Rituals are done together. Sins of a sexual nature also are about being in the community or out of the community. Right? Okay, so I'm going to stop there because now we come to Sara and Sarai, but let's ask for any questions or comments on any of the stuff we covered today. Yeah. Right. Because they're part of your household. And anyone who's part of your household has to be brought under the covenant. Right. Remember, it's not the person doesn't come in the morning on the bus, you know, make you a meal and leave in the evening. In some ways, this is one more indication of the attempt to make slavery different in quality from what it is in the ancient world. That is, someone who's a slave is supposed to be a real member of the household, is supposed to be able to take part in the things that you take part in, and they can't if they're uncircumcised. So that's why. Yeah. Does it presume that that person wants it? There is a principle in Jewish law that you can do something without someone's knowledge that is good for them. I assume that the presumption here is that, yes, anyone would want to be brought under the covenant of God. They may not like the inconvenience required along the way. But this is a common and a dangerous religious principle, right? Because of, you know, at what point do you say you don't get to decide what's good for me? However, if you're the master and that's the slave, you do get to decide what's good for them. It was, you know, a slave is still a slave. You may be better to be a slave in the Bible than it is to be a slave in Greek society, but it's still a slave. Yeah. With a foreskin, you bury it. And the reason that you bury it is that it's part of the human body, and the human body is supposed to be buried. So it is a tradition to bury it. In the same way, by the way, in the same way, although different, that if you lose a limb, you're supposed to bury that as well. Any part of the human body should be buried. So, yeah. Well, I don't know where it came from originally, but it is very ancient and very widespread. Lots and lots and lots of... Actually, the question might be reversed. You might ask, where did the Jews get it? And obviously, as we saw from the beginning of the class, they got even if they didn't get it from other traditions, they knew it from other traditions, right? Abraham doesn't say, what, you're kidding? You want to do this to me? Because it's a custom that's familiar to him. So I think that it would require an anthropologist, and I'm sure that there is anthropological speculation on why people do that, but probably for some of the reasons that circumcision is in the Jewish tradition too, which is it's a very powerful symbol of fertility, generativity, sexuality, that doesn't cause lasting damage, which almost anything else would. So, yeah.
What's the significance or relationship to naming the baby on the eighth day?
Right.
And you, not, normally not before.
Yeah, I, well, I mean, you name the baby on the eighth day, partly, you know, it's superstition. But I guess that it has to do with the fact that also with the idea that the child isn't an independent being until that day. So maybe that's a signal that the child isn't independent until the eighth day. Remember that, as I said, according to Jewish law, really, you don't accord full burial to a child who hasn't reached his or her eighth day. So that might be the reason why you don't name till then, even though people often do. And even now, you know, it's a very, it's especially around something as fraught and as dangerous as childbirth. There are lots and lots and lots of superstitions, lots of them. I mean, people who won't buy baby furniture before the baby is born. You know, there are places where, in very traditional neighborhoods, where you can buy the furniture and they will hold on. You call them from the hospital and they will go to your house, deliver it, set it up so that it's ready for the baby when the baby comes home, but they will not deliver it before the baby is born. And also other sorts of superstitions. I mean, I still remember my mother telling me that when she was pregnant with my oldest brother, that she was watching television and a circus came on television and some monkeys were in the circus, and my great grandmother, her grandmother, dived in front of the TV so the baby wouldn't come out like a monkey, so that she shouldn't see that. Yeah, and my older brother has some simian feature. No, so that, you know, and so around childbirth, there's a lot of, yeah. The parents usually bury the foreskin.
I don't have one, so.
Right?
We have group questions here. Never done.
What's that? Or the moil. Or the moil, right? You know, there are a lot of foreskin jokes, and I'm going to stay away from all of them. The most recent one, actually, I heard from my oldest brother. Right, exactly. My oldest brother, the monkey. But anyway, go ahead. I'll say it. I was in response to the fact that my second brother had sent around this article that there are some very valuable and old books in libraries scattered through Europe and some of the United States that are actually bound in human skin. And he wrote that, and my older brother wrote a joke back about an encyclopedia that started as a book. I'll leave you to guess. But go ahead. I've never heard of burying the umbilical cord. I think because that falls off on its own and therefore is not considered part of the human body. It's like hair, right? I mean, that's my guess. I don't know. That's purely speculation. I would have to look it up or ask someone. Yeah, but it also is not, it's not a permanently attached part of your body that is removed. Just like you don't bury fingernails, you don't bury hair, you don't bury anything that grows back, and I don't think you bury anything that falls off naturally. So. Yeah, I have never heard of doing a baby naming after 8 days. I mean, before 8 days. But the truth is, I haven't. What's that? Yeah, maybe. But I haven't heard. But on the other hand, I haven't heard of any prohibition of it either. So. You know, I don't know what the. You know, I'll have to look. I mean, the truth is that there wasn't a ceremony until fairly recently. So I don't know what the. But I have a. What's her name? Deborah Nussbaum Cohen's book on which has baby naming ceremonies for girls, and she may say actually what the halacha is of that, if there is a halacha governing it. I'll take a look. Yes. The idea of not cutting a child's hair for 3 years is that you don't prune the fruit tree for the first 3 years that belongs to God. So it's the analogy with that. So you also, a child, since a child is like a tree, for the first 3 years you don't prune it as though you're making that offering to God, and then you do that ceremony called an upshirin. At least that's the analogy. No, it's not in the Bible. It's not in the Bible. One second. What's that? I've only heard it applied to boys. So, yeah.
If this is a covenant, is it not a more constant reminder of God than the wearing of a kippah?
Kippah.
Isn't that supposed to be
Yes, I suppose in some ways it's a more constant reminder of God than wearing a kippah. But it also isn't, because it's not visible.
You wear the constant reminder.
You're talking about circumcision to other people, right?
Because your covenant with other people.
Sure, you do. Both. Also, even I have to tell you, in the course of an average day, I am conscious of wearing a kippah more often than I'm conscious of being circumcised. I wasn't even trying. I mean, that's the truth. I wasn't even trying to be funny. And I'll close with a very nice comment about a kippah. Since you said about a kippah, I was once on a panel with Avram Berg, who is a member of Knesset in Israel. And someone asked him why he wears a kippah. And this was actually even made more poignant by the fact that he happens to be a tall guy. He's like 6'2". But he said, "I wear a kippah so that I will remember where I end." Which I thought was really good, you know? Because sometimes it's very hard to remember where you end and something greater than you begins. So anyway, all right. See you next time.